Welcome to Worlds Apart. Despite all the Western military assistance and the escalating rhetorical animosity, the conflict in Ukraine is still constrained by some unspoken understanding between Russia and the West as to what's allowed and what's not. Where are those red lines and what may happen if they're crossed? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Vasily Kashin, director at the Center for Comprehensive European and International Studies at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Mr. Kashin, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you have a reputation of one of the most detail-oriented observers of the Ukrainian conflict in Russia, and you pay attention not so much to the ideology of it, but, you know, military hardware, the numbers, the trends. So I want to use this opportunity to ask you, where are we at this point?
We are probably at the turning point of this conflict. We see that the progress of the Russian forces is the fastest since spring of 2022. Since the beginning of this year, Russians have been making significant gains, and sometimes the most difficult, the most fortified Ukrainian positions, such as Avdiivka, have been taken faster than it took to conquer much weaker fortresses in the past. The new offensive in the north of Kharkiv region is additionally complicating Ukrainian position. Ukraine blames everything which happened on disruption in the American assistance. However, that's a major exaggeration, because apart from the American assistance, which never actually stopped completely, there was also very significant European assistance.
Can I stop you here for a second? Because, you know, this conflict has been asymmetrical and to some extent illogical from the very beginning. Is Russia actually benefiting from gaining on the battlefield? And the reason I'm asking this is because, you know, the more tactical or strategic gains one side may have, the other side will respond asymmetrically with terror attacks, with, you know, other forms of pressure. So is Russia really benefiting at this point from military gains?
Some of the Russian conquests reduce Ukrainian ability to conduct terrorist attacks against Russian cities. For example, the capture of Avdiivka eliminated the most dangerous Ukrainian position which could threaten Donetsk, and decreased the number of artillery systems which could potentially be used to attack Donetsk, because when Avdiivka was in Ukrainian hands, they could use almost everything, including heavy mortars, to attack the city, which they did regularly. Now it's becoming much more difficult. The same is happening in Kharkiv Oblast. Russians are trying to take areas which were used previously for indiscriminate shelling of Belgrade, such as attack before the New Year's Eve in the end of 2023, when more than 100 people were injured. So if we create a security zone along the border, which was basically mentioned by President Putin in the past, and that should be a relatively wide security zone of dozens of kilometers at least, that would already improve the security of the Russian territory. And at the same time, we could threaten major Ukrainian political and defense industrial centers such as Kharkov.
Now, speaking about this security zone and its potential boundaries, I heard you say before that preserving some sort of a military bastion in Ukraine for the West is still considered a preferred outcome, but the West doesn't really concern itself with Ukraine's territorial integrity that much. Mm-hmm. I wonder, though, if there are still some strong prerequisites there, because if, let's say, Ukraine loses access to the Black Sea coast, its strategic and logistical value as an asset is set to decrease.
As we see from the statements of some Western leaders, including the statements by the French President Macron, they will try to prevent capture of Odessa by the Russian forces. This is one of their red lines when, if they see that such a danger emerges, we might witness an escalation.
Can we talk about this so-called red line? Because, I mean, in this conflict in particular, there were many red lines and many were crossed, and especially with the French president, his words sometimes not very substantive, to put it diplomatically. Are there capabilities, real capabilities, for the West to do what it proposes or what it states?
There are capabilities to start a major escalation that will require a huge appetite for risk-taking, because what they will need to do is to send very significant forces into Ukraine and start directly attacking Russian forces. Otherwise, they cannot affect the outcome of war. What Macron is currently trying to do, he is trying to create a situation of strategic ambiguity, and he hopes that will force Russia to restrain itself.
Now, Russia is also, I think, toying with strategic ambiguity, because President Putin has never, or his military commanders have never, stated firmly whether they have an interest of moving the Russian military contingent to Odessa or Kharkiv, for that matter. How do you understand the Russian calculus at this point?
I believe that Russian goals are evolving during the course of war and depending on the current situation. I believe there are firmly stated minimal goals. Russia will try to get to the external borders of the four new regions, and Russia will try to force Ukraine to accept political conditions which would be close to what was in Istanbul agreements. These are the the minimal goals. Plus, probably Russia will try to establish and keep some kind of safety zone along the border of Ukraine with the with the pre-2014 Russian regions. So this is what's happening in Kharkiv. At this point, Russia will probably be ready to negotiate on the conditions which I described above. However, if the other side will continue resisting, Russian forces will continue their offensive operations. And of course, it should be understood that territory which would be taken by Russia with significant sacrifices cannot be given back. So initially, Russia didn't want to change the territorial status quo at all. And if Ukraine and the West agreed to Istanbul agreements, Ukraine will would control the same territory which it controlled before February 2022.
Now, at the time when the Istanbul agreements were ruined, as you say, under the pressure from the West, many Western policymakers talked about the need to subject Russia to a strategic defeat. We are not hearing those statements anymore. But my question to you is, how do you understand operational goals of the Western participation at this point?
At this point, the goal is to save the current Ukrainian regime as a functioning and minimally economically viable state, which could be gradually rebuilt, rearmed, and turned into an asset in a long Cold War against Russia. Not necessarily they're counting at Ukraine as a potential military force for the future, because the damage which was done on Ukrainian economy and resources is too significant. But undoubtedly, Ukraine will be used as base for various subversive, clandestine, hybrid operations, which basically is the fact even now, and it has been the fact since a very long time, since 2000s, and there were publications in the West about the CIA bases in Ukraine, which are focused on working against Russia, and which were created at least at 2014, if not earlier, basically information about cooperation of the Western intelligence services with the Ukrainian intelligence in working against Russia emerged much earlier. So still it will be a valuable asset. Russian goal is, of course, to prevent it from happening, and this is why so far they're not easily reconcilable. We'll need to soften the Western position.
Now, I heard you say in another interview that even if the war stops, Ukraine would not be able to provide for itself in civilian terms for the foreseeable future. I think last year its domestic budget was by 60% filled by external forces. This year, the figure may be higher. I wonder if that makes the war a cheaper option, because if you have some sort of a peace, that would inevitably raise a question of reconstruction, which can go into, you know, much higher numbers. Isn't it more profitable for the West to, you know, keep this asset at the, you know, low-grade conflict rather than deal with, you know, rebuilding that?
Well, it's not more profitable from financial point of view. The situation is, in fact, very dire already. Ukraine required certain amount of assistance to function as a state even before the war, billions of dollars per year. Now, Ukraine is getting every year an amount of assistance which is comparable to their 2021 GDP. Ukrainian 2021 GDP was about $200 billion. Now they're getting something like close to 100 per year, and all of the Ukrainian economic dynamics is basically defined by amount of this assistance. If the war stops, for example, stops now, what happens next? Of course, some problems will be removed. Additional damage to the Ukrainian infrastructure will stop. People will stop to die. However, many problems will still exist. For example, in order to mobilize people to war, Ukraine made absolutely huge financial commitments to the families of the fallen soldiers. They are supposed to get a very high amount of money, which is divided into portions. Like they're supposed to get something like 15 million hryvnias, which are divided into several batches over several years. So since the losses of the Ukrainian forces are already significant, there will be huge burden of money they will need to repay in like coming years to these families. Of course, they can cheat and they can cause artificial inflation, but that will create huge discontent. They will still need to rebuild the military, and that will be done on foreign health, on foreign assistance, yes, money. They will still need to maintain their state apparatus, and on top of that, there will be rebuilding. At the same time...
Mr. Kashin, if I may stop you for a second, because we need to take a short break, but we will return to this very hot topic in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Vasily Kashin, Director of the Center for Comprehensive European and Security Studies at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. Mr. Kashin, before the break, we started talking about the promises that the Ukrainian leadership, the current Ukrainian leadership, gave to the soldiers and their families of huge payments. And during the break, we tried to calculate how much 15 million hryvnias would be in the convertible currencies. And you say that it's roughly several hundred thousand US dollars.
Yes.
So that's essentially on par with, or perhaps even higher than the payments that American military personnel
receive. Comparable to what is paid in the West, as far as I understand. That, yeah, but it's in several parts over several years. And to get this money, family of Ukrainian servicemen need to present all of the data, including the identification of the corpse, and that is difficult. So they have
even if they provide all of that, I mean, given the state of the Ukrainian economy, it's hard to understand what's the budgetary basis for that kind of promise.
Well, partly there is no basis. There is, first of all, the foreign assistance, which of course depends heavily on internal political situation in the donor countries, which can get tired of that. Another way out for the Ukrainian budget is just to cause artificial high inflation and inflate these promises, which is quite likely.
It's interesting that you mentioned that they are counting on foreign sources, because during the last couple of months, as the American Congress was considering this aid package, the issue of pensions, not just huge military payouts, but simply paying pensions out of the American money, was a pretty hot topic. Do you think their sponsors truly understand what they're getting themselves into?
I think they fully understand. They don't necessarily tell this to their parliaments and to their to their public opinion, but of course the officials, the military, the intelligence officials, who deal with Ukraine, they understand this fully. There will be huge need to pay pensions. Another issue which will be happening, currently there are millions of Ukrainians, mostly women and children, living in Europe. They're adapting to life. They're getting jobs, going to schools. Their men are currently forbidden to leave the country. Once the war stops, the borders are open. I think it's more likely that not these women and children return to Ukraine, but rather their men will go to Europe to rejoin them. That would probably create additional demographic decline and significant downward trend for the Ukrainian economy. and make situation worse.
Now, given the costs to Ukraine that you just mentioned, and not only to Ukraine, but to the West itself, the need for military support, you know, multi-billion dollar assistance to pay subsidies, demographic losses, etc. Until recently, it was generally assumed that the West is sort of gearing up for a low-grade war of attrition that takes away resources from Russia and undermines it from proper development. I wonder, though, if the Ukrainian hotspot is such an effective way of solving the Russian question, because apparently it's not cheap. What is what kind of a bang they're getting for their bucks?
They're getting almost nothing, because if we talk about Russia, inside of Russia, Ukrainian conflict started a very dramatic change of the whole Russian political economy and model of development. We see that large sectors of the Russian economy change hands. Some were renationalized, some went from international companies to the local Russian companies, and the composition of the Russian ruling elite has changed significantly, and not in the direction that the West would like to see. And as for the West and the spending on Ukraine, it will be long-term absolutely huge. The losses are comparable, the financial losses of the West are probably bigger than the Russian financial losses because of the freezes of the Western assets inside of Russia, and because of the fact that many Western companies had to sell their businesses in Russia at hugely deflated costs and to pay increased taxes for that. And even after the war stops, the West will need to spend many dozens of billions of dollars on Ukraine every year, or still face danger of very humiliating geopolitical defeat. Because if they fail to spend this money, then Ukrainian state will just collapse without any particular effort from the Russian side, and they will have to deal with this problem anyway. The Ukrainian leadership will probably be happy to have a low-intensity conflict, a constant martial law, avoid elections, and continue getting external financial assistance, precisely because they understand that once there is peace, it will be much more difficult to pass the huge spending on Ukraine through the American and European parliaments.
I want to ask you one more question about Zelensky, because clearly there are no sympathies for, mm-hmm. for him in Moscow. And what's surprising is that over the last couple of months, we have heard more and more criticism from Western military professionals about how wasteful and absolutely negligent, if not cruel, he is about using his own human resources, both civilian and the military. But I wonder if at this point, Moscow would prefer him to stay or to go, because the Kremlin often goes by the adage, better the devil we know. And at this point of time, it looks like, from what you're saying, Zelensky is hurting the West more than it hurts Russia.
It's documented and it's described many times in the Ukrainian media and in statements of Ukrainian military experts and officers that Zelensky did personally contribute to some of the military disasters witnessed by Ukraine since the beginning of war. Especially he, on a number of cases, insisted on indefinitely defending hopeless positions, which were
for propaganda purposes.
Yeah, which were, yes, demi-surrounded in order to prove the Ukrainian resilience to the West, as he saw it, or for propaganda purposes, or just because he had his own unconventional views on warfare. That was one of the reasons for his constant conflicts with the previous commander of in chief of the armed forces of Ukraine, Valery Zaluzhny. Of course, some of these characteristics of Zelensky are good for Russia. Russia never tried, contrary to what he says, Russia never tried to kill him. There haven't been any strikes against the government quarters in Kyiv. And some months ago, Russia has shown video footage of Zelensky's visit to Kherson, which was taken from a Russian drone. So at least once there was an occasion when Zelensky was watched by the Russians real time within the range of their artillery, could be easily eliminated. They've done nothing. So that's it. Zelensky's incompetence is good for us, but at some point he will become a problem for everyone, because he is the person most interested in endless continuation of war, no matter what. And even if at some point Russians will go much deeper into Ukraine, he will prefer to fight until the end, even until he needs to evacuate to NATO territory and form a government in exile, rather than talk to the Russians.
Do you think NATO would actually want him on his territory? Because, I mean, what's the point of them hosting somebody like that?
At some point, probably he counts probably that at some point they will have no other option and will have to accept him. However, I believe everyone understands gradually that he is becoming problematic. And, you know, in the history of Cold War, various things sometimes happened to such political leaders.
Well, let's be open. The Americans practiced targeted assassinations not only against foreign leaders, but also, you know, some have speculated against their own. So
against their, yes, pro-American leaders of some pro-American puppet regimes, which became too problematic. That happened during the Cold War. Who knows what happens now? For Russia, I believe the best is situation is that he just has to change his mind and starts to negotiate. That's why Russia avoids any personal attacks against him physically, and basically indicates that Russia is ready to talk to him, and he has to take all of the measures to prevent these talks from happening. And some of these measures are just not his decrees banning him from negotiating from Russia, but also terrorist attacks against the Russian civilian targets and population, which, as he hopes, will make negotiations impossible.
Okay, well, Mr. Kashin, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you for watching. I hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.